This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rastam today. Just want to ask the question, first of all, how are you all doing out there? Because it's been an interesting week, has it not?
Really, what's been going on?
Oh, yeah, just some stuff. I'll tell you later. So anyway, with me, Cam Rastam today, we have the returns of She Works here at BFM. She is a head honcho at the video team here. If you haven't seen their videos, you must check them out. She is Rahma Fawzi.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me back.
And he is, he's a writer, he's a director. He is Naam Murad.
Hi, good to be back, as always.
And our three topics this week are, topic number one is, because we want to be in keeping with these difficult times, topic number one is cat videos.
Facts about cats.
Oh, facts about cats, yes. Even more important.
The guy who chills everybody out. We're talking about politics, and there's always somebody who posts pictures of kittens. I'm that guy today.
Okay. On the other hand, topic number two is the censor in my head. And finally, topic number three is new ideas about democracy. So, no, I mean, you know...
Let's start with facts about cats.
Because it's important that we know these things in these troubled times.
Yeah, yeah. So you can, you know, like rest your weary brow and just think about cats, even if you hate cats. Okay, well, I'll start with fact number one. I have three simple facts. Fact number one, everybody here knows that the domesticated cat comes from Felis silvestris libica, which is the Egyptian wild cat.
I totally knew that, yeah.
Everybody totally knew that. And separate from the European wildcat, which is related, but so untamable, right? So we know for a fact that they were tamed in the Middle East or North Africa, probably in Egypt, because they had, you know, grain silos and stuff like that. And these cats came and ate rats and eventually became human friends. But what you didn't know, this is about almost up to about 10,000 years ago, but what most people don't know that about... From 4,900 to 5,500 BC, Asians had our own attempt to domesticate cats. Okay. Oh. This happened in China, of course. Everything happened. All the great stuff happened in China. But it was a different cat. It was the leopard cat, which is this wild spotted cat that you see. You know,
that's a big cat.
Could you see them still here?
Well, you see, that's the thing. You can see them in the wild. We have them in the wild even here in Malaysia, right? The evidence is basically just, you know, cats that were buried with their masters and stuff like that. But they were obviously domesticated, which is strange because they're quite feral. They're quite wild. But apparently it went on for quite a few thousand years, but it just didn't work out. Maybe not as well as the Egyptian wildcat. Eventually, if they look through archaeological history in China and other places that had the leopard cat as a domesticated cat, it was taken over by the current cat, the Egyptian wildcat. Ironically, some of you may know that the leopard cat has come back into the domesticated trade because you've heard of the breed called the Bengal cat.
Ooh.
The Bengal cat is one quarter leopard cat. So ironically, the leopard cat is back, you know, like stating its mission that you know, we want to be domesticated too. Oh. But with a Bengal cat, they have to be quarter leopard cat before they're safe to become, because now it's all breeders and all that, right?
So they can,
before it's safe, because they are too wild. So that gives us a clue why it didn't work out the first time.
So once every, my math is really bad, four generations or whatever, mm-hmm. you have to get a wild leopard cat and breed it with a
you have a whole bunch of people in the beginning having a leopard cat, and they would breed it with a spotted cat. A spotted tabby, so you will get that look in the first place, but it will be enhanced. But the what they call the F1, the first generation, is probably too wild. Only breeders kept them, so they kept on breeding them with spotted cats. So only a cat with only quarter leopard cat was available for the masses.
And that's very recent, right?
70s it started, and it's only being prevalent. Okay, I'll get to the next one, else I won't have enough time. And this is very interesting too. That cats, you know, everybody says that cats have no emotions. Dogs are the ones who are like happy.
False.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I agree with you, because it says here, Because cats don't have the facial muscles that dogs do. Dogs have more facial muscles, so therefore they can smile and grin and all that. Cats have that cool face, right? That you know, they're
I love that face.
Yeah, I know. They're like, we don't care, but actually they care. But the thing is, what they found out is that cats' brain is, when it comes to emotionally, right, the biological centers of the brain which control emotions is 90% similar to humans.
Uh-huh.
So they do feel a lot of what we feel. Just they can't tell us. You know, they can't do a fed up face. Or they
but
can't,
I think behaviorally speaking, I think they're quite transparent with what
quite,
they feel.
Once
though.
They know how to communicate
exactly,
with you, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so cats actually are closer to humans than dogs. So take that, dog people. Okay, one more. Okay, this is actually the one which got like interesting. You know, got culture, got everything. Okay, so have you guys noticed that? Cats, our cats, right? Asian cats have like kinky tails, like, yang pendek, twisted, and it's been a thing, and it's a very Asian thing.
The Bangkok one and all that.
Yeah, and there are breeds even in Japan. They have and when I was younger, it was more prevalent. And the thing is, why it's that way in Asia is because all our domestic cats came from our contact with the Middle East and the Western world, mostly sailors from European countries who had cats in their. On their ships, but it was always a small amount of cats.
Are you saying that there were no cats before that here, or
no domesticated cats? After that, whatever happened in China up to 4,000 years ago with the leopard cats, we had just wild cats. Maybe every now and then somebody would have, but we didn't have domesticated cats until. But nobody knows how long. But it could be a long time. Ah, I'll get to that. That's very interesting, because it's always been a small amount of cats, so they were always inbred. And this kinky tail stuff is from inbreeding. It comes from inbreeding. But it's not a dangerous bit of inbreeding. It can be. Sometimes it can hurt their spinal column and they can be a bit fragile that way. But as you can see cats with kinky tails and they are totally hardy, totally tough, and they live good long lives.
And
right?
This includes the one with like really short tails too?
Yeah.
I see.
I've noticed over the recent years that the kinkiness is getting less and less.
Because
it's disappearing.
Because it does make sense. It's inbreeding. Because since the 80s, 90s, we are beginning to import cats. Before, all our cats, when I was a kid, all the cats that we had in Malaysia, it was rare that somebody working for a foreign company or whatever would take the trouble to bring their cat in and their cat might be fixed. So all the cats we had in Malaysia were from small spurts of cats coming in from different ships or whatever, from traders and sailors. So it was always inbred. The cats were always inbred. And now, because people are actually... The cat trade is international and people are allowed to bring in cats from everywhere else. The inbreeding is going like, almost all my cats have straight tails.
Because you've got a part Bengal.
Yeah, I got a part Bengal. His tail is completely straight.
Yeah.
But,
one of the posh stuff or not.
He was found under a car by my nephew.
Are you serious?
Yeah, serious. Somebody.
You should have sold it.
No, he's my boy. Okay, anyway, but one last thing. We don't know how long this legend goes on, but there is a Malay legend that explains it. There's a Malay legend of a princess. Of course, a totally made up princess lah. Tak ada like this princess. Okay, this Malay princess went to a waterfall or probably a lake with her pet cat to have a swim. But she had a lot of jewelry as princesses are wont to have. So she thought, what am I going to do with my jewelry? So she thought, maybe, you know, I'll just put them, all my rings and stuff, on the tail of my cat. You know, the tail of the cat, like you know that jewelry thing that you
yeah,
have? You
know?
Like, so apparently it came from that. She put all her jewelry and went to swim. But the cat saw a mouse or something and it got excited and shook its tail and all her jewelry got missing. So the next time she went, she tied a knot in the cat's tail in order to keep her jewelry from flying all over the place. And as it, you know, as Darwin said, right, if you do it to one animal, no, but you know how legends are, right? It always happens to one animal. The baby elephant gets its nose pulled by the crocodile. And so
that's Lamarckian. That's not Darwinian. just to be clear.
That's Kiplingian, and, you know, like Melayu legendian. Yeah. So that is my three facts. So do you guys have any questions for the cat man?
Well, we've run out of time, though.
Well, at the end of the show. That I wish it did not end.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, we have to move on. But what I enjoyed there is that it's like watching a cat video, which I think, I don't know about other people, I've been doing a lot of in the last week or so.
Oh, yeah, I've been doing a lot.
Yeah, but the one thing I didn't ask Ali to do for me was to have like really quirky banjo music. you know, like most of them. Yeah. Somebody whistling in the background, because that's what usually why I can't stand these cat videos. Great videos, but the most cheesy music you can imagine. Yeah. I usually mute it. Anyway, so let's move on to less important things.
Exactly. So now topic number two, less important things. So I don't know. Some of you may have noticed the last week or so, there's been some there've been some changes here in Malaysia.
Oh, that's what I heard.
Yeah.
Some really good shows have had their final episodes, right?
That too, but I'm thinking in the world of politics.
Oh,
and,
that. Okay.
And a number of us, not everybody, I mean, some people are very, very happy about this, but a number of us, I think, have been feeling quite shell-shocked, rather stunned, hence watching cat videos. And I've been reminded of something that happened that I read about that happened in 2010, 2011, during the Arab Spring over in Egypt, in Cairo, when there was a news reporter. And she was speaking. This is just after President Mubarak had been deposed. Mubarak, who died just a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. He'd been deposed. And she was talking to the camera. And then she suddenly stopped. And she said, I've just realized I don't have to listen to the censor in my head anymore. Because, as far as you could tell, suddenly this world of freedom of speech had opened up before her. Now, unfortunately for her and for... the people of the Arab Spring. It turned out it was a bit short-lived.
Didn't last very long.
Was
she the one who actually chewed out this old Pakji, this ulama? I remember seeing a video.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't know.
Okay. So was this realization came as she was going on air? Is that what you're saying?
If I remember rightly, and I haven't been able to find it since, you know, as well as she was talking, she's like stopped. And of course, there came a time for her, I don't know how she processed it, when she did have to start listening to the censor in her head again. Mm. And, you know, I don't know why I should be thinking of this topic, but things have changed here. And I look back on two brief years and I think, I'm not one to say too much, I don't think, politically out loud. We have differences between our sort of public personas and our private personas. Speaking on radio is no different from just talking to people. You choose your audience as you're talking. So I wonder if just these 2 years will have made a long-lasting change. I think of some young, very young people I met just the other day. And the way that they were speaking, they just didn't comprehend that there could be, should be, any breaks on what they can and cannot say out loud.
I wonder if they were always, was it something that was, for the past 2 years, have they been very vocal? Is that why they felt like...
Maybe some of them, but I mean, these are people who are like maybe 20 years old now. Mm-hmm. So, I mean...
They didn't think about it when they were 18.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, a lot happens in those 2 years.
So you're saying that they suddenly started feeling like they had to turn this thing back on?
They've never had this thing on. They've never had the sensor in their head.
Yeah, now that they're adults, they felt like that's what we've all been doing all these years, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I'm well trained on the sensor in my head. I know 25 years of...
I work in television, sensor all the time. Yeah. But Cam, one thing I find that it's kind of connected. That what I liked about social media, especially for the past 2 years, was not so much that people could say what they want to say to really like attach themselves to a issue and really, you know, go for it, really fight for it. I think in the social media, even before GE14, people were like that. But what I felt, what I'm going to miss, is the fact that certain controversies, you could tell that public opinion really affected how these things, I mean, like, remember the Aflix thing, right?
Right.
It was literally shut down by social media. People were very vocal about it. People even found photographs that were damning. And that literally, without even like the government stepping in, the people who were involved in it just backed off and said, okay, we're not doing this. And that was totally people power, I think.
Well, maybe the genie is out of the bottle and you can't put it back in the bottle. I don't know. Rama, what do you think?
Yeah, I would like to say that I don't think it's necessarily self-censorship. I think it's also, or like a censor in your head, right? Like, I don't think it's that. I think it's also just what we needed to go through 2 years ago was to just know that there is an alternate way to do things. And right now, the moment we went out there and we came back here, or not come back here, whatever, don't think of us as digressing. I think we're just like at a third phase of things, whatever that thing might be. And this third phase just involves you being able to say things, you know, before this 2 years happened or after this 2 years happened, and whatever the possibilities might be. So I think we needed to go through this. And like in some weird way, whatever that happened the past 2 weeks was a graduation for us to show that this is to test you whether or not you can still keep going with whatever that, you know, you've been given or you were awarded, whatever, over the past 2 years. And was it really an external forces? Was it really an internal forces? You know, so I think that's like an important thing to distinguish. And I would beg to differ, Cam, in fact. And I don't think, or for you for that matter, because I didn't think that things were going to be different that much. Because social media changes, the way we engage with technology change. And before, you thought that you could, you know, have all this, like, you could build a firewall around the internet, and, like, as if, like, people could not, you know, find how other people interact and how people engage with things. And I think people were already, like, going towards that, you know. Yeah. And I think Arab Spring probably just, like, a beginning of it, you know, in 10 years ago. But right now, that's just how we
graduated. The chains were already off.
Yeah, it was already there.
Long before.
Yeah, that's how I would argue it.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm with you on that one. And I think that the chains are, in many ways, impossible to put back on. We're not the 1970s anymore.
Yeah.
I think people are going to sit still if the same amount of censorship and, let's just say, repercussions were to happen that we were used to from the 90s and stuff like that.
Maybe that's all that you need. You just needed to have that nudge. And right now, I'm not that worried, honestly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Good. I'm going to end on that.
We were just nervous old men. But I think...
Yeah. Because we've seen the bad times.
It's warranted, though.
Yeah, we've seen the bad times. And, but yeah, okay, I'll go with that. The chains are off. Yeah. And in a moment, though, we're going to talk about, new ideas for democracy here on the show that discusses things like this. A bit of culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Na'am Murad, and Rahma Pauzi.
Hi.
And so, Rahma, you've got a thesis.
Oh, yeah, I did.
And...
She did it over lunch.
Yeah, and it's some new ideas for democracy. Please tell us.
Okay, I'm going to try, all right? Just to be clear, I read a bunch of stuff because, like, you know, over due to frustrations, due to trying to make sense about what was going on. So I did some reading, but at the same time, I managed to speak to a pretty world-renowned political scientist, Wong Chin Huat, who's right now at Sanwei University. So on Monday, I had an interview with him for, like, one of our video content that's coming out hopefully later this week or early next week.
Nicely done,
I know. So what we discussed about was the structure of our society. So we've been thinking about democracy as majority rule. But what does that mean necessarily, right? And we keep talking about this unity. We keep talking about swinging that majority back to, you know, where the ideals should be and all that. But at the core of it, democracy essentially is practicing and compromising and embracing division. Party in democracy, to begin with, part, it's, you know, the word that signals division to begin with. So I think moving forward, so what Wong Chin Huat proposed that really captured my attention was, so he was saying that before, society was such in, like, it was in a bell curve shape. So the majority was in the center. That means that for you to be moderate is for you to win. You would be able to, like, win the majority, whatever that means. But in modern days, I mean, which is right now, or postmodern for that matter, I think we should be looking at democracy as, so before you would think democracy is like 60-40. So these days, it's probably going to be 40 is, like, you know, the party that's going to end up ruling the government or whatever. And the 60% are not necessarily people who are against them, but...
So they're broken apart.
Yeah, they're broken apart. They can't coalesce. They just have too many different school of thought. Right, too many different.
It's not black and white anymore.
Yes, it's not black and white anymore. So what Chin Huat argued in that interview was the fact that right now, as society becomes more sophisticated, as societies get richer, as globalization, it's coming to all other countries in the world, and then as globalization is happening, we tend to have much more insights about how the world works. So what used to be a singular bell curve now has turned to be an M-shaped curve. And as society progresses, you would only see more waves and more mountains in these graphs. And what I'm trying to propose right here is that stop looking at things as how do you want to unite people at the top, because that is no longer how democracy is going to work. If this is a system that we should stick with, we have to embrace division, and we have to acknowledge that there will be more differences moving forward. In our different interaction previously, you mentioned that right now it seems that there's a liberal camp and there's a conservative camp, whatever that means, right?
That's what everybody perceives.
Yeah,
right?
Everybody perceives. But even within that liberal camp, like the moment you graduate to a different content, so for example, child marriage. Oh, okay, so this is what you mean by child marriage. No, but that's not necessarily what I mean. But I'm against child marriage, but in this way instead.
Yeah. So I mean, if you take everybody in GE14 who voted for PH, for example, and then you widen the scope about, okay, what are your what is your opinion? Then you will find that within that group, it's not united. There are divisions. There are things that are very, very different wants and needs, and those have to be. But is that what you mean?
Yes, that's definitely what I mean.
I'm not quite sure where you're going towards with this. So how would this affect voting? How would our participation, one of the most important parts of our participation in democracy is voting. But we have one vote. How do we come in with all these various bell curves?
So I'm guessing, right, it's important to start looking at our society as, a cluster of different communities, little communities. So what we need to look at is empowering people on much more local level, instead of looking at things, being fixated with like whatever that's going on the top. And one thing to also realize, over 10 days or the crisis happening, we were so fixated who was going to be the minister. It was reduced to that point as if like our country's honor or like our nationhood or whatever is completely on this hand of this person we call prime minister. We forget about policymaking. We forget about local empowerment, So I think the moment we reduce things to become that, then it's a lot harder to cope with democracy moving forward.
But when you find that you have the same divisions even within a small community, or do you feel that
and that's why I say, like, I'm not sure what it is.
People have to kind of like
okay with it.
Yeah, I feel that almost like a group, whether you're talking about liberals or conservatives, have to be able to be more open to not just what they want. They can get what they want, but you should allow others to get what they want too, and not see that as or some have demonized
It doesn't
thing
cancel something else doesn't cancel immediately. Something, yeah.
I'm cool with all this, brothers and sisters, but
by all means necessary, brother.
But I don't understand how this works in a one person, one vote thing.
I know, that's what she's saying. There's got to be a way.
So you're creating a whole new system.
I think that's like a way for. So first of all, it has to start with mindset. So you cannot simply just impose, okay, let's replace one person, one vote with something else. I don't think it works like that. I think it has to come from your mindset, right? Embracing it. And from that, then only, I don't know what that is, honestly.
So if let's say I have a certain kind of set of opinions when it comes to the environment, I could cast a vote for an environment minister. And then if I have a different set of opinions on economy, I could cast a vote on economy.
Possibly. Yeah, right. Women's issues, children's issues, health.
But I do disagree with you, though, with the notion that the singular bell curve is becoming many, many lumps.
Mm-hmm.
In that if a canny set of politicians can find a way to coalesce a community to imagine itself to be a singular mass, let's say, Malay, then they can, and if they can find a way to frighten those people into thinking a certain...
Well, that will never happen.
No, obviously not. I'm being hypothetical here. Then you've you go back to the bell curve. If politicians are clever enough and use these...
You find an issue that overrides all the smaller, all the lumps, as you call it, you know, all these other things that people are passionate about, gets washed away by one frightening issue. But nobody will do that.
Yeah. No, because Brexit is the... Brexit for Britain was that. Trump has been that.
Okay,
Marie Le Pen, all of them.
But what I'm saying is that, like, I think it's easy for you to say that everything is moved towards that direction, but it's not necessarily like a good bell curve. The bell curve might have shifted a little bit, but there's a, it's like a volcano if you look at that bell curve.
So
like, doesn't
shapes,
mean that.
I'm so holding shapes, in my head.
So in between this, this bell curve has like a bit of a dent at the top. So it doesn't mean that.
This is getting like a pimple that just pops, right?
Yeah, but I would argue against that. I think, and that's why, in that sense, there's like Trump and there's the Bernie camp. Like, I mean, whatever that you're trying to fight in the middle, it doesn't work. So you could say that, what if this one politician who's able to like gather everyone over this one issue that they fear? You could say that. But in Malaysia, it happened on both camps. Like, I think... So like, the way I see it, it's like it's happening on 50% of the population right now. And that's what I'm trying to argue right now, that as much as we see that, oh, the world's changing, you are changing the way the world is changing with you, which is like you are changing to become more of the 50% and the other group is changing to become more of the other 50%. So they are just beginning, you know, that people are making two camps right now rather than just like uniting under this one umbrella, I don't know, that used to be unified.
Okay, so there are two camps and... We allow the two camps to... See, then I get confused.
I'm not so sure. Well, I'm not saying that I don't agree with you. I just don't, I can't think of the solution.
I cannot think of the solutions. And that's... Yeah, and I'm being transparent about it. And I think that you can no longer think of democracy as majority rules because that's not... how it's supposed to work.
Yeah. Right.
Think of a manifesto.
Like
it's a very elaborate manifesto, but I think voters sometimes will ignore the rest of the manifesto because one thing is important.
Yeah.
But then the political party has to serve every point of that manifesto in order to satisfy their promises.
Yep.
You see? But that it becomes difficult now because...
Well, we've got to move on, but I'm gonna steal your...
Cats again?
I'm going to steal your subject, though, Rahman, by finishing with a story of... I have a story of a man who, in 19th century Britain, he went to a fair, and the fair had competitions where you had to guess the weight of a cow. And one person is unlikely to get it right because it's a very complicated thing. How heavy is that cow? But so everybody would put in their guesses and the winner got, well, whatever he got. This man went and asked the person who's holding the competition, could I have all the different choices? He took all these different choices and he averaged them out and he found that of all these people who had chosen, if you averaged it out, they chose precisely the right weight. Wisdom of the crowd, that it is possible for a crowd, once faced with a singular choice, can by average actually find the correct,
the right cow.
That's one issue.
One
so if we could actually just make politics about choosing weights of cows, we're sorted.
That's the country I want to live in.
Yeah. So anyway, people, we're going to move on.
Recommendations, right?
Recommendations. Na'ar goes first.
Oh, gosh. Okay. I'm rereading Alfred Wallace's The Malay Peninsula again. And it's an amazing...
Archipelago, sorry.
Not about the peninsula at all, actually. Malacca, briefly. But the thing is about it is that as you go through, it's about nature. Once you wade through all this stuff about him, you know, like, because back then, if you wanted to study animals, you had to kill it and cut it open and stuff like that. If you're a nature lover, you're wondering, why is this man doing this? You can't wait through.
Perhaps we should just be clear. Alfred Russel Wallace was younger than Charles Darwin, and he was here in the Malay Archipelago, the name of the book, in the early 19th century.
When you could not, you couldn't take a picture of an animal, study it on your laptop. You had to shoot it, kill it, skin it.
And then he came up with the
well, part of the, he couldn't find natural selection. This is not about natural selection.
I just want to be clear on who he is.
He was almost where Darwin was, except for he couldn't find a mechanism for evolution.
Yeah. So
what I found interesting about it, nothing to do with the animals. Once you get past, he would go on and on about butterflies, which is the most boring thing in the world. But what I found interesting is he went from Malay Island to Malay Island, Malay Java and all that. And you would see, I won't say what my opinion of it is, but I read it, and he had observations of the various Melayu, we consider Malay races, whether it's from Makassar or Java, different parts of Java, Malacca and all that. And it's very interesting to see the variations and the similarities and how, in a way, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, how the same we are still today.
I see you're censoring. You're listening to the censor in your head, aren't you?
No, I'm not.
You can't say it.
What else are they trying to say?
I'm not, because I haven't quite finished the book yet.
Oh, so, nice. So one.
But when you see the same things about how the society works, how leadership is in a way, kinds of things. Slightly different, but it's very interesting. And this is us, the general Melayu thing, what was it, 130 years ago, right? Mm. About 140 years ago.
1870 or something. Yeah.
Quite a long time ago. So read that book. Read the Malay.
What's it called?
Malay Archipelago by Alfred Russel Wallace.
Yeah, it's classic. It's a classic.
But it's 80% nature stuff. But you know, it's that's wonderful too.
Great illustrations.
Wonderful illustrations. Yeah.
Well, it just so happens that my recommendation is kind of similar. It follows on neatly from that. It is a new book, though, by a journalist, a really long-time Asia journalist by the name of Philip Bowring, and it's called Empires of the Wind. Mm. And he has written this wonderful history about, well, the Malay Archipelago.
And ships and trading
and stuff. Oh. And he's coined a term called Nusantaria to describe...
But it's Ria, not Nusantara, but Nusantaria.
Happy Nusantara. Yeah.
which is stretching from Sumatra in the west or to the Philippines over in the east, right, and everything in between.
Timor and Sulawesi,
exactly. And talking about the interconnectedness of this part of the world. And what's really wonderful is that he's collated archaeology, and genetics for that matter, and aerial photography, and all the different ways to be able to write history that is so much, it's more about pre-colonial times than post-colonial.
The expansion of the Polynesian, in a sense, or the Malay Polynesian, right?
Yeah. Well, he doesn't go all the way up to so much the Polynesian.
No.
It stops down kind of...
So Moana is not in it?
No, it's not.
This is my canoe. Okay.
And that's not history either. And it's...
No, Disney is history.
It's really wonderful, though, to begin to understand and see the interconnectedness and how... certain myths kind of being exploded, how Malayness is a concept that's been evolving over time, constantly changing.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but not everybody considered use the word Malay,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Malayu was actually an ethnic community, and mostly in Riau, in fact.
The Riaulinga.
So Jawa was Javanese people would never call themselves
Malayu.
It's
only now
Malayu.
That, yes. Because I remember a Filipino friend saying that, in school, when you reach the point, they say, we are considered Malays. And you're like, what's that? It was like, okay, well, you know, that it's become a designation created by anthropologists, right?
Yeah. So it's really wonderful to read this book and sort of see histories.
Sounds great.
And also a history that doesn't just start with Alfonso de Albuquerque arriving in Malacca, which is in so many ways the way you know, what was there before?
Yeah, yeah.
And he really fills it out. So it's Philip Bowring, and it's Empires of the Wind.
When was it written?
It's just out. It's still only in hardback. Okay. I think it's not going to come out into paperback for quite a few months yet. So it's fresh off the press. He used to be the editor of the Far Eastern Economic Review.
I see.
Oh, okay.
And things like that. And he writes for Wall Street Journal.
Where does he get all his facts? I mean, this must be difficult to research.
Probably from
stuff.
Reading your book.
No, there's not much there.
I've been scanning through the footnotes, and it's sort of it's covering archives from China and you know,
wow,
and everything. So it's really well researched, and I can't. I mean, what do I know? But I can't sort of spot any flaws in its argument. So yeah, so good book, Philip Bowring's Empires of the Wind, and Rahma.
Yeah, I have something. My recommendation is just as sophisticated. Whoa. Which is, or if not more, an Instagram account. It's called Influencers in the Wild. I'm not sure if you
Influencers in the Wild.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but it also comes, you know, like I picked this one is due to also my fascination with people, but not in ways that you've described, you know, the Malay community is very sophisticatedly. But, so Influencers in the Wild is basically just like people taking videos and pictures of influencers or like anyone who tried to get their picture taken like influencers, you know, okay. With all this like gaya and coolness and all that. So basically the behind the sceneness of what goes into that amazing picture of that amazing person.
What do influencers get up? How do they plan this thing?
Yeah.
Is it more a Malaysian thing? Or?
No, it's all over the world. Yeah. Okay, so cool. Sometimes they're just like, snapped by like a stranger, you know, basically, you know, peeking at these people, you know, doing weird stuff in front of like, I don't know, monument or whatever, trying to like get that particular, Ali's looking at it.
Producer Ali is showing me as you speak.
So basically I think it's a bit of, it's quite interesting because, you know, all this like images and videos that you see of influencers on Instagram are very well curated. The colors so amazing. It's so well proportioned. And then all this, you know, at Colosseum, at Pisa, at KL Tower and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But then you don't know what gets into it.
What's behind it?
Yeah, which is probably like a 30-minute worth of, you know, shoot just trying to get that one perfect picture, you know? So it is actually a job. So you could go out, you could check it out, and then maybe, you know, after scrolling, you would either end up with feeling of fascination, just like, oh, now I appreciate influencers where it's such, you know, you don't simply just do things.
Soon influencers will have influencers, or they will have, you know, like people behind them saying like, okay, this is how to be an influencer.
Exactly. This shouldn't be like a how-to thing. But it's more of a bit of like a parody account, just trying to like, you know, make fun of these people. But to me, it's just fascinated looking at.
Rahma, yeah. Are you influenced by influencers? Are you an influencer?
Okay. Funny enough, like I do have a few accounts that I follow that I thought it's quite funny, and I think it does, you know.
What kind of stuff are you influenced by when they say and do?
I'm not influenced by influencers, but I am very entertained by them.
Okay.
I'm influenced by, you know, people that interview, like Wong Xinhua that I described earlier. But I do enjoy the likes of Bretman Rock, for example. this makeup guru who is like, I think like he's like 21 or 20 years old or something. Basically just like talking about the cereal that he eats, which mascara that he likes, and also dry ice that he orders from Amazon when he's pretty high on weed. So it's just like, to me, these are like, you know, funny content. This is like how I do escapism. If it's not cat content, then it's this kind of influencers content. But Influencers in the Wild, check it out.
Okay, so that's a recommendation from Rahma Parsi, a philosopher and...
influencer analyst.
Actually, I watched a little video, very short video, the other day, and there was this beautiful blonde woman, right, and she's riding a horse, and the horse is kind of swimming in the sea with like white golden sands, clear crystal
sunset kind of thing.
And I was thinking, this to me was like the nadir, the apotheosis, the whatever of influencing. That is such a lie. That moment is just pure lie. Nobody does that.
I know. Yeah, the horse probably hated it.
Yeah, the horse is probably drowning.
Stop doing this to me. That, and that's probably like, I don't know, the 30th time that she attempted it.
That's right.
Which is precisely what this Instagram account is trying to document. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, even so. She's probably like,
how phony it can be. It can be. I'm not saying
it could be. It could be. But to me, it's more fascinating.
Okay,
yeah.
So, fascination. So that's Influencers in the Wild.
Yes. Check it out.
Instagram account. Afterwards, Na'ar Rahman, I will tell you what Instagram is. And because I'm one of the kids. So that brings us to the end of the show. And only remains me now to thank special honored guests, both of you, Rahman Fawzi.
Thank you.
And Na'ar Murad.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me again.
All right. And I hope we're all going to be okay. As I say, some people are very happy about this. Very happy.
Very happy.
Very happy.
Because you don't expect to be happy sometimes.
Yeah.
And okay, don't sound so bitter now.
I know. And really happy in ways that are really kind of...
Where is this coming from, yeah?
That's interesting language about your neighbor.
I thought we were exactly the same.
Anyway, so with that in mind, producer Ali says that we can end with a song. So we're going
to
end with
a
song.
Do sing?
No. By a professional singer. And it's a song I've wanted to play for a long time. The thing is, producer Ali actually can never play it because it's so long. It's like 8.5 minutes long. And I don't know. I just thought that it's apropos our times. And if you've never heard it before, I think you're in for a treat, and do listen to the end. And it is a song by The Who, and it's called Won't Be Fooled Again. And so that brings us to the end of this week's show. Please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.